Best audio program. When we introduced this category, probably I think it was 2 years ago, I think we had about four entries, and there was 15 or 16 entries this year. So it's obviously become a very competitive category. So I'm just handing over to Hannah to announce the winner.
So there's only one name. And the best audio program is Risky Business.
Hello everyone and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is sponsored by Kaspersky Lab. Thanks, Kaspersky. But as you heard in the intro, Risky Business picked up an award last week. Best Technology Audio Program. So this podcast somehow managed to beat entries from the Australian Financial Review podcast, The Scoop, a radio program from 2GB, a stack of stuff from CNET, and we actually won. But wait, what's this? What's this we're hearing now? The award for best title? You know, the award that goes to the best technology publication in Australia.
And now the best title? The publication that won this award scored the second highest ever score in their individual category and won by about 11 points, scored an average of 9 out of 10. So I'm going to hand over to Jonathan.
The best title goes to Risky Business.
So apparently, like, according to the judges, Risky Business is the best technology title in the country. What the f***?
One of the things that I have championed on our website is niche publishing. And there is no better example in the past 10 years of quality in niche publishing than what Patrick has done with Risky Business. So, well done, Patrick.
Dude, I like this podcast too, but it's not that good. Come on, man. Seriously, but thanks. The Australian Financial Review actually won that award last year. Before that, it was a TV show called Good Game, all about computer games. For the ABC, but I nearly had a heart attack when they announced that Risky Business had won the big award, thought we'd gloat about it in this week's intro, so check, that's done. Moving on to stuff you actually care about now, and this week we've got an interview with HD Moore. He is, of course, the creator of the Metasploit project, a project he sold in somewhat controversial circumstances to Rapid7 last year, and the company is releasing a commercial version now of Metasploit. HD joins us after the news headlines to talk about the commercial variant of his baby. And after that, we'll be joined by Vitaly Kamluk from Kaspersky Lab in Japan for a chat about the merits of doing research in the open and how that can actually be detrimental to the security of our community. It's interesting stuff. But right now, it's time to look at what's been going on out there in InfoSec land over the last week with our regular guest, all-round nice guy and cultivator of one of New Zealand's finest Unix beards, Mr. Adam Boileau. Now, Adam, in the big news story of the week, and it's just broken over the last couple of days, McAfee has managed to balk. I believe that is the correct technical term. They have managed to balk the systems of many of their customers.
Oh, man, did they ever screw this one up. Hey, this is it's just amazing.
Somewhere there is a pooch that is royally screwed.
Oh, man, yeah, probably a whole litter of pooches.
Tell us what happened.
So they shipped a virus update DAT file, and it marked the servicehost.exe as a virus.
Well, of course it is. It's, only a component of Windows.
Yeah, and if you apply the patch, apply this antivirus update, which of course happens automatically if you're doing it right, and your machine then, next time it reboots, goes into a reboot loop and never comes back. And the only way that you can fix it is by dropping into safe mode and, kind of manually either applying McAfee's patch or kind of backing it out yourself, which is pretty catastrophic when you drop, tens of thousands of workstations overnight, which is, of course, what happens if you've got a large organization and centralized patch management, which, of course, is exactly what we recommend.
Mm. I mean, this is, look, would you agree with me when I say that this is amateur hour stuff?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and McAfee is saying, well, I guess we didn't really test it on XPS v3. It's like, excuse me, what the f***?
Yeah, it is the most common enterprise OS, I would think.
Well, exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, you know, I can understand maybe, you know, identifying some third-party application file, but what the hell, man? It's like a Windows component. It's a Windows service. Like,
and one of the core ones.
I know. How can you get that wrong?
Yeah, no, it's pretty bad. And you have to say, you know, like, what's the impact of getting a virus versus this? So, like, if you're one of the organizations that's been seriously affected, and we had some pretty big important stuff affected over here in New Zealand, you know, if you're one of the people who's got been affected by this, then, I mean, say, compared to getting Conficker, you know, which of these is actually worse?
I don't know, man. That's kind of a tough call because I know Conficker did some pretty heinous things to a bunch of networks.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in terms of the amount of time you're spending cleaning it up and the amount of problems that it causes you, I mean, I know one of the other stories we were talking about is that the Coles supermarket chain in Australia had a bunch of its stores shut down by this.
Yeah, because 10% of its POS terminals got shut down. It's interesting, too. Ben Grubb got that. Well, he appears to have been the guy who got the story, and he wrote it up for ZDNet, and it wound up on CNET over in the US. So that's actually gone global, that story. But yeah, in WA and South Australia, a few Coles stores wound up getting closed. I also heard that it affected the 911 systems in the US. A few hospitals had to switch over. Now, look, there's a really interesting element to this story, which is actually the day before it broke, I had a tweet from a listener who actually said, and I'm reading from it directly here. It says, have you heard anything about SDAT files from McAfee being corrupt? Haven't gotten a good one all month, half the usual size.
Curious.
It's so you're very thinking, curious.
Some kind of, well, I mean, flaw in the testing and production process of the files,
I'm
or
thinking
sabotage,
we might be
or
dealing with a bigger problem internally with McAfee at the moment. I mean, look, that is just conjecture. That is just based on one user's experience. But they were concerned enough about it to actually write to me and ask me if I had heard anything about corrupt DAT files. So maybe we're dealing with a, I mean, look, it's just wild conjecture. I haven't even put in a call to McAfee, which I should before I start shooting off at the mouth like this. But it's an interesting little coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed. And I suppose it'll be, you know, whether anything comes out of it will be interesting. I mean, I'm sure McAfee's hardly going to come out and say, oh yeah, by the way, we got our, you know, updates processed, hacked by Chinese, you know, our bad, sorry.
But the Chinese have become the most awesome scapegoats, man. Anytime anything goes wrong, it's Chinese hackers.
Yeah, all those pesky Eastern Europeans.
Yeah, or the Eastern, but that's more the crime stuff. Like, if it's a DDoS or sneaky espionage stuff, it's the Chinese. If it's financial fraud, it's the Russians.
Yeah, damn them.
Yeah.
Commies.
But it's easy, man. I don't know. You know, Marcus Ranham always blames stuff on Liechtenstein, which I think is kind of more creative.
Yeah, totally.
Moving on to the next story, and this is one that I pulled out for the intelligence community listeners. There's been an interesting presentation at Black Hat in Europe. Please tell us more.
Yeah, so these guys gave a presentation describing methods for tracking people's kind of general geographic location based on interacting with a cell phone network. And they pulled together, you know, a number of components that, you know, are not new or interesting, but by, you know, combining them in an interesting way, you can actually extract data that you otherwise wouldn't have. And so what they've done is they've hooked up you know, voice over IP system, and connected up into the global phone network, and then from there are able to query via some VoIP providers in the EU, query the location, or like the routing information for a particular phone number. So if they can map a person to a phone number, then they can start to map out exactly which part of the global kind of GSM phone network they're in, and then from there infer what they are, you know, in what location they are, and track them as they move around. And then they also carried out some attacks on voicemail systems using caller ID spoofing and that sort of thing. And these are not new techniques, but they've combined them in a new and interesting way. And I think that the result is quite interesting, you know, that they, you are able to kind of track people without having the resources of you know, a nation state or a telco to do it.
Well, or if you are trying to track someone in a nation that isn't necessarily cooperative.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think if you were an intelligence organization and you needed to do this in a non-cooperating country, this would be quite a useful technique. And I, you know, I'd be surprised if they weren't already doing it.
You never know, man. I mean, maybe some agencies are, maybe some agencies aren't. So interesting, anyway. I mean, it's a good trick.
It's a good example of the democratization of these kinds of sophisticated electronic intelligence techniques, you know, things that were traditionally very much the realm of government and state organizations only. And, you know, now, you know, you can do it yourself with a couple of open source software packages.
Yeah, and a few beardy Unix guys like you.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, look, this next story, as it turns out, you can own a Palm through WebOS, like by sending it a text message.
Yeah, this is a pretty tragic story. I mean, the particular vulnerabilities that they're talking about are, you know, basically cross-site scripting in the user interface of the new Palm WebOS that they run on their new cell phones and PDAs. But of course, the bad thing here is that they've built this entire operating system for their smartphones with, you know, a web kind of, you know, a web metaphor using web technologies, and they've just completely missed what it means from a security perspective. I mean, you get the idea that somewhere someone went, wow, we've got to have one of these web things, like build us a web operating system for our phones. It'll be awesome, you know, up in the business and marketing managementy layer. And then some tech guys are going, well, I don't know, what's a web cell phone look like? And just kind of made something up and without any thought about what it actually means. And you can't. The contrast couldn't be starker between, say, the iPhone and the WebOS. I mean, the iPhone operating system's, you know, sandboxed, signed code. Like, they've done a lot of work to try and make it robust, amazingly, for Apple. Mostly from, you know, point of controlling what goes on. But from a security perspective, it does a pretty good job. And if you look at the Pwn to Own competition recently where they exploited the iPhone, like the amount of work they had to do to actually get code execution on the iPhone is, you know, it's a reasonable amount of work and quite sophisticated. Whereas this, man, have they ever just completely f***ed it up.
Yeah, no, it looks pretty bad. You know, a bunch of guys from a company called Intrepidus, they said, and that's the quote, "We feel that Palm put almost no thought into security during the development of WebOS. All of the low-hanging fruit discovered should have been identified in the most basic of threat models, which should have been performed during the very early development stages." So it looks like it's just riddled with bugs. So WebOS, Palm devices running WebOS, do not go there.
Yeah, definitely. Stay the hell away from that.
Okay. Now, moving on. And look, this is an interesting little story that comes to us via CBS Interactive in the United States. A bunch of journalists got a hold of 6,000 used copy machines and cracked them open and looked at the hard drives. And it turns out nearly every digital copier built since 2002 contains a hard drive. And it looks like they store, a lot of them are configured to store images of every single document copied, scanned, or emailed, right? So, yeah, that's kind of bad.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story because, I mean, to people like you and I, like the fact that photocopiers are computers and contain hard drives and store copies of all the documents that you copy or fax or print through them, like that's no surprise to us. But, you know, I think it is to most people. And in the video segment on CBS News where they ran this story, they actually had the results of a survey by, I think, Canon, where they asked, you know, a bunch of average Americans whether they thought that photocopiers kept a copy of all the documents, and 60% said no. So it does demonstrate that there is a problem here, which is that the general populace who use these things, you know, treat them as an appliance and don't understand that you need to scrub them clean.
Well, especially after, you know, the office party when everyone's been photographing their ass cheeks and not realizing yeah. that they're like, you know, that they're actually burning images of their bumhole and testicles onto a hard drive for the world to keep forever.
And if only it was, you know, if it was just bumholes and testicles, we'd be all right.
But it's actually corporate secrets and agreements and contracts and all sorts of stuff.
And this actually, in this particular story, the CBS one, they went to a warehouse where they, you know, you can buy secondhand copies, bought four at random, took them back and pulled the discs out. And the contents they got, one of them was from like the local police department's sex offenders unit. One was from like the local cops' narcotics, and they had like list of people they were investigating for drug use and like and drug busts and things. And another was a medical insurance company with, you know, all sorts of very sensitive medical records. So I mean, they got a pretty good haul, you know, just for, you know, picking four at random. And I know that you know, my experience and some of my friends and colleagues who've, you know, bought secondhand discs or secondhand tape units or secondhand servers on like local auction sites, every single one of them is filled with interesting corporate info.
Yeah, it really is interesting too, and I wonder how many CSOs are, you know, aggressive in enforcing secure disposal policies for things like copiers.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a pretty basic step. I mean, it's a, you know, something that you would think we would have to take care of pretty early on in the process, you know, compared to, say, you know, intrusion prevention systems or, you know, other expensive, complicated, you know, bits of technology like that. Something like making sure you securely get rid of your crap. Just like you have a shredder or a document destruction bin or whatever.
Yeah, like that hard drive in the corner with all of your documents on it. Don't give that to that guy over there.
And don't sell it. Well, don't give. I suppose the real problem here is that the leasing companies don't have any procedure to wipe kit. I mean, you get equipment on lease in a big business, and then you send it back when it's out of lease, and they just flog it off. Certainly at least part of the leasing contract, you would imagine, would be scrubbing the data off. So at least you'd had some recourse to go and blame your leasing provider.
That's it. As long as you got someone to blame, it's all okay.
Outsourcing the blame is very 2010. Like, that's where I think the focus of the industry is going to be this year.
Well, I think it's called cloud computing. Yeah,
exactly.
Moving on to this next story, Adam, and just a very quick mention. Last week, we discussed that Java exploit that went from a couple of days of being released into being exploited in the wild. We're seeing the same thing again. The Zeus botnet is using currently a PDF flaw that was only disclosed a couple of days prior. There was proof of concept released, and then bang, bad guys were using it straight away.
Yeah, well, I guess it demonstrates the amount of resources they're putting into it. I mean, turning around an exploit, depending on how complex it is, in a couple of days, right? I mean, that does take some smart people and probably a few of them.
But it is a trend. I mean, that's kind of the point that I'm getting at, is that, you know, it used to be you would see stuff, a few months after it was first sort of discussed and there was proof of concept code with some broken shell code or whatever, it would eventually find its way into malware. These days, it's friggin' instant.
Yeah, well, I mean, the weaponization process, I guess, itself is better understood than it used to be. And some of these vulnerabilities in the PDF format have been pretty straightforward, let's be honest. But it's certainly a sign of the times, I guess.
And in other news originating from Google, Adam, Google says that 11,000 domains are now distributing rogue antivirus. This news comes to us via Secure Computing Magazine in the United States. This is interesting because I personally know a few people who have been suckered in by this. This is a big deal for users, not so much in the enterprise space because, you know, if something's popping up saying pay us for corporate, you know, pay us for AV in your corporate environment, you know, you go tell your admin, but, you know, users don't have any protection against these scams. And holy God, 11,000 domains are distributing rogue antivirus now.
Yeah, well, it certainly lasted as one of the sort of the stalwart techniques of making money out of people on the internet, scaring them with tales of viruses and data loss and threatening that bad things are going to happen and then providing them with an easy tool to fix it. It works very well. Like, it's a scheme that, I guess... judging by how many domains are doing it, is very successful for them.
And in somewhat related news, we've actually noticed some of these rogueware peddlers have been feeding off this McAfee situation. They have been actually advertising fixes to, the McAfee problem, and they're using that to sort of get their stuff onto people's systems. They've actually got it quite slick. They're actually a very effective marketing operation.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. And, the extent to which they use search engine optimization and pick on things that are bubbling up through the search engine to peddle their wares. I mean, obviously, something that is a legitimate problem with some antivirus software is a great time to go and sell alternatives, whether they're legitimate or not.
And in this final story that comes to us via Wired's excellent threat level blog, it looks like a second banker rhymes with tanker, a bloke.
You know what they say, that the group noun for bankers is a wunch. A wunch of bankers.
A wunch of bankers. That's an easy one to get wrong, I can imagine. Now, it turns out, we heard some news a while ago of a guy, I think it was at Goldman Sachs, walking out with a high-frequency trading algorithm or something, high-speed trading algorithm. Another guy from Société Générale, that is the French bank, where that guy got busted for $7 billion worth of dodgy trades a while ago. Like, I think that was almost a couple of years ago now. This bloke has been busted for walking out with... their algorithm. Apparently, these algorithms are very closely guarded IP and apparently targeted by insiders.
These kind of stories, I suppose we're going to see more and more of this because, these algorithms, as you suggest, are so important to the operation of financial markets. And, now that things are traded so fast and so quickly and for so much money, of course they're a target that's very, very valuable. And if you've got access to the underlying algorithm and you can predict what it's going to do, then that opens up all sorts of options for being able to make money on the back of someone else's trading.
I don't think it's so much the threat is front running. I think it's more actually about being able to take that algorithm to the competition and use that as an edge in terms of being able to place trades quickly for clients. You know, I think that's really the threat here to companies like Goldman and Societe Generale. But you know, because they're big evil organizations that are, you know, basically like someone described them as? Like a giant, like, leech or something on society. They're a blight, so.
They are indeed, yeah. And, you know, maybe someone will go and own them all up and steal all their proprietary algorithms and post them on WikiLeaks, and then that'll be that.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Anyway, Adam, that actually takes us to the end of the week's news. Thanks again for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
Thank you, man, and congratulations on your win.
Adam Bialow there. It's time now to check in with HD Moore. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the company HD now works for, Rapid7, is releasing a commercial version of Metasploit. Given that Metasploit was an open source project until not so long ago, this is almost certain to piss a bunch of people off. So this interview is done in two parts, more or less. The first part being, tell us about your new toy, it sounds cool. And the second part being, how dare you sell out and charge for something with Metasploit in its name, you money-grubbing bastard. Anyway, HD joined me via Skype a couple of days ago for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
Metasploit Express is the first commercial version of the open source framework. It's something that myself and other folks in the Rapid7 Metasploit team have been working on for the last 3 or 4 months, and we think it really solves a niche that isn't being addressed by other commercial products in the market. This isn't us trying to take Metasploit and commercialize it so much as it is building a completely different product that happens to use some of the same code base as the Metasploit framework.
What does this thing actually do that's different to the Metasploit framework?
Well, the Metasploit framework is really good if you're a pen tester or a security auditor and you know exactly what you need to get done. For example, if you need to test this brand new exploit or need to try this particular attack against the network and you already know what you're doing, you can jump into Metasploit and get it done pretty quickly. The type of user that we're shooting for Metasploit Express is someone who either doesn't have a lot of time, either a pen tester who needs to test a really large network really quickly, or somebody who isn't quite as sophisticated as your hardcore pen testers.
So you've made a product for idiots.
It's a combination.
I'm joking, man. Come on.
Well, we want to be able to help out the idiots. We want to make sure that the idiots actually have some way to deal with the test of security. At the same time, we don't want to dumb down the product to the point that you can't get to the cool things that actually make Metasploit as a core product useful today.
Yeah. So you're selling this one. This is for the MCSEs.
MCSEs, but also the pen testers who have to cover 20, 30,000 nodes in 4 hours. We're looking at covering both ends of the spectrum, which is a little bit challenging.
Now, I remember we were having a chat a couple of weeks ago, and I asked you what you'd been working on, and you said, you know, you remember that episode of the Simpsons where Uncle Herb gets Homer to design a car? You sort of described this product as being somewhat like the car Homer Simpson designed, you know, with 16 sunroofs and 42 camshafts and a, you know, 500 horsepower engine and a bubble dome and like a, you know, big gulp cup holder. Is this the pen tester's equivalent of Homer Simpson's dream car?
That was my worry, was that we'd end up with a product that was so specialized in what we're trying to do and so much exactly what we want to get done that it wouldn't really apply to the commercial market. Since that discussion, we've actually done two internal beta rounds, one with the Metasploit development team, including the community team, and a second one with some of our key partners and enterprise customers. The feedback from both of them is that it's not the Homer Simpson mobile. It actually does do a lot of things that are pretty practical, and they've been seeing a lot of value with it so far. So my worry was that by having my head in this, you know, buried in pen testing for so long, I'd build something that was so specialized that only, you know, someone with the same mindset as myself could use it. But the end result is we have a product that we think just about everyone can get their hands dirty with and get some value out of.
So which products is this thing actually designed to compete against? I mean, is it its own sort of thing, or are you pretty much going up against Core and Canvas?
Well, we think we've got a product that does something a lot different than existing commercial solutions really do. If you look at products like Core, look at products like Canvas, and they really cover different niches. Core goes after the large enterprise market, somebody with, you know, both a large budget and with not necessarily a large degree of sophistication. They really try to have, you know, the full top-to-bottom automated pen test as they define pen testing. As an actual pen tester, though, my view on it is a little bit different. in most penetration tests, you're not really using exploits more than maybe 10 or 15% of the entire engagement. The exploit may be the original way that you get into one particular server, but all the work you do after that point of entry is just data analysis. It's, you know, gathering data from the system, crawling through it, finding other passwords, then trying to apply those passwords to other systems. So what we're trying to do with Metasploit Express is actually cover the other 20, 30, 40% of what you can automate in a pen test without actually going through and trying to go, you know, head-to-head with something like Core, which is a different focus than I think of where we want to go with this product.
So you're trying to basically automate the process of a pen test, I guess, which is kind of a funny way to do it. Like, go forward and fetch me a credit card database sort of thing.
You got it. That's exactly what we're trying to do. I mean, we have three folks on the Metasploit development team who have been pen testers for 3 to 5 years, depending on who they are. I've been doing it for a lot longer than that, but it's a case where we know exactly what we need to do. When you walk into a site, you say, okay, if I know if I can get at least one administrative password for one machine, I can then apply that password to every other machine in the network and basically take over the entire domain in about 5 minutes. Now we need a tool that can actually automate that process, make it easy to use, and actually show that chain of weaknesses in the report, so you can actually explain it to the customer and say, this is how I got in. Currently, there's no product I know of that does that. There's no product that really goes in and shows exactly how you exploit those trust relationships or how those passwords can be reused across the network.
Do you think there's a risk this software could become self-aware and destroy humanity?
Well, when we get closer to that, hopefully it'll tell us.
Now, I noticed that you've got a feature chart here that I got in front of me. We're looking at stuff like features like, quote, automated database compromise. I mean, what the hell does that mean?
So there's a lot of tools out there right now that allow you to do things like brute force a database password, or do a configuration audit of a database after you give it valid credentials, or allow you to actually exploit a vulnerability in a database based on missing patch levels, like the SQL Slammer bug, things like that. What we're trying to do with Metasploit Express product is cover all of those. So we start off by brute forcing accounts, and we can brute force against things like Microsoft SQL Server, MySQL, Sybase, DB2, Postgres, you name it. So after you manage to gain an account with one of these databases, either by brute forcing passwords or by taking a password we obtained from a different system and we gain access to that database, then we can do things like automatically elevate to a command shell or a remote interpreter shell on that target, and then use that to even gather even more passwords and more data. So it's not just doing exploits, not just doing password auditing, not just doing configuration auditing. It's kind of combining all those together in a single button you can push and say, hey, go own this database.
Yeah. So it really is more about workflow automation than building the maximum number of exploits into a DB.
You got it. I mean, we're still using the Metasploit framework itself as the core backend for all of the exploits, all of the payloads, a lot of the actual auxiliary modules in the backend. So when we're building this product, we're actually putting a lot of our code straight to the mainline source tree. Our exploit developer who works on the Metasploit Express product doesn't commit to a private code tree. He commits directly to the open source code tree that everyone can actually download and use.
Before we get on to talking about the controversy which is likely to ensue from this, how much? What are you guys actually charging for Metasploit Express?
Well, if you look at market today, the high-end pen testing products are so far out of the scope of your average either small consultant or your small enterprise admin that they just can't afford to use them. You look at products that are coming in with 30K or even 60K minimum price points, and it's impossible for someone coming off the street to use the product. Now, the products that are much lower price points are still complicated enough that you can't just pick them up and go if you don't have a strong security background. So we're really trying to shoot for something right there in between, and we're looking at $3,000 per user per year for the Metasploit Express product.
Okay. Now, I'm going to switch gears and turn hypercritical on your ass, because what you've done is you're releasing a commercial product with the name Metasploit on it. Now, this is something that I'm sure is going to piss off a lot of people. You would agree, right, that there's going to be some backlash here?
Well, there's going to be controversy about it. We think we found a really good balance between open source and commercial, and we're doing it in a way that I don't think anyone else has really approached it.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, when you actually sold the project to Rapid7, you know, you certainly made a commitment that Metasploit would remain, you know, open and free. And now we're seeing a product here that has the Metasploit name and indeed a lot of the functionality of Metasploit. You've built all of this extra functionality, but it's not in the public domain. It's something that you're going to charge for. Can you see that some people will say that this is, you know, this is a bit of a change in direction from what you said you were originally going to do?
It's not quite a change of direction, because what we're still doing is we're still providing the free version of Metasploit with no changes in the development model, no changes in how many resources we're applying to it. The only thing we're actually charging for in this case is new code that we developed since Metasploit 7 acquired the project. So everything that's been included in Metasploit Express that drive the automation, the workflow, the reporting, the UI, all that's brand new code that was done on Rapid 7's dime to build the product. So we're still maintaining the open source framework. We're still pushing development of that forward and adding exploits to it. We built kind of a secondary product off to the side that happens to use some of those features that we're actually selling as Metasploit Express.
But won't that framework, the original Metasploit framework, sort of more or less become redundant as you keep adding new features that are part of the commercial product? Won't it sort of devalue what we originally started with as the open source project?
I mean, it's a good argument that the thing that we're really trying to do is hook the commercial wagon onto the open source piece. So what we're doing is we're not actually forking the source tree. We use the exact same code base that anyone can download as the core engine behind Metasploit Express. So there's not two trees. We're not going to start building duplicate functionality. We're going to build it once in one place, which will be the open source version. Then we're going to build the automation workflow and analysis into the commercial version.
It occurs to me, though, that there would be far less controversy if you actually just changed the name of this product to, like, Ultrasploit Express or something like that. You know what I mean? It just seems that the Metasploit name being attached to this is gonna drive people a little wild.
That's true. I mean, there's definitely some challenges with using the same name to describe both a commercial product and an open source project. The reason why we want to use the name is we're actually proud of the open source roots. We're not trying to hide the fact that we're using open source software. We're using a licensed version of the Nmap scanner. We're using the Metasploit framework as the core for the exploits and the payloads. And we're not trying to hide that like a lot of other commercial companies do when it comes to open source use. What we're trying to say is, here's an open source project that we've been working on for the last 7.5 years. And now here's a commercial piece of that that you can use to make things much easier to use, much easier to automate.
Was that your idea to use the Metasploit name, or did that come from Rapid7?
It was actually back and forth. Surprisingly enough, it was the Rapid7 marketing folks who really drove home the point that we should use the Metasploit name.
I don't find that surprising, actually, but yeah.
Really? Well, because we had a couple other names in the pipe that we were talking about using for the product, but none of them really had the... let's take the flip view of this. Let's say we call the product something like Nexploit or Ultrasploit or something like that. People would say, okay, you've got this thing called Ultrasploit, but really isn't it just Metasploit? And we always have to go back and try to discuss what the differences were between Metasploit and Ultrasploit.
Can't win, don't try.
So at this point, I mean, we don't really have to try to separate the products because we really are saying it's the same product for one third of it. The other two thirds are what make the commercial product Metasploit Express.
How does what you're doing compare to what, say, Sourcefire or Nessus are doing, or Tenable?
Something a little bit different about our development models, we're not trying to charge for our exploits or have a time delay in the release of our exploits. So when we add an exploit to Metasploit Express, it's going directly into the Metasploit framework open source code base first. So what differentiates the Metasploit Express product from Metasploit framework has nothing to do with exploit covers, nothing to do with the underlying feature set. It has to do with the automation, the usability, the reporting, the configuration, and all the things that we actually put into the Metasploit Express piece that solve the usability and kind of macro functionality pieces that you can't really get out of the free version of Metasploit.
Yeah, I mean, Sourcefire, though, you would find that the snort sigs are all open source, right?
Somewhat. They have some signatures that are binary only due to the agreements they have with vendors. They also have a time delay for signatures unless you're a paying subscriber. That's somewhat similar to what Tenable does with their vulnerability checks for the home version of the Nessus scanner.
Okay, so you're not doing that. All of the exploit information will still come from the Metasploit framework, and there will not be a day when we see proprietary exploit information only being available to Metasploit Lite customers or Metasploit Express customers.
Absolutely not from us at all. There may be third-party vendors who sell their own exploit packs, but that won't have anything to do with our business model or what we're doing.
All right. Well, HD Moore, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business, as always.
Great. Thank you, Patrick.
HD Moore there with a look at the new Metasploit pen testing tool. And Metasploit Express, as it is called, will be commercially available in early May. Next up, it's time for a chat with our Russian friend, Vitaly Kumluk of Kaspersky Lab in Japan. And we're talking to Vitaly about public malware research. He thinks some researchers go a little bit too far when it comes to publishing results. They'll pull apart a bit of malware, spend hours analyzing it, and then they'll say something like, aha, the person who wrote this virus screwed up this part here. Then, of course, a couple of days later, the malware updates itself and the problem is fixed. It frustrates people like Vitaly, who, as you'll hear, generally believe in open research. And it's funny, too, because we actually had Paul Ducklin on last week's show talking about a similar idea. So it seems that AV guys, people from that AV background, generally get a bit annoyed when security types start publishing too much. Anyway, Vitaly even suggests regulation as a potential solution to the problem. Now, personally, I think that's unworkable, but it's an interesting perspective nonetheless. It's a uniquely Russian perspective, I guess, because those guys know a few things about regulation from 20-odd years ago. Now, it's a position that I think most listeners of the program will disagree with, but Vitaly actually makes some very interesting points. Like how we like to think that open research benefits the community and it's some sort of really high ideal, but in fact, a lot of companies just exploit said research for marketing and PR and, you know, getting media coverage. And, you know, I'm guilty of coming along for that ride, I guess. So, you know, it's an interesting point. It makes me think. Anyway, Vitaly, join me by Skype for this chat. Listen with an open mind.
Yeah, actually, I have such worries. Well, describing the architectures and the implementations and especially the flaws and the mistakes and the weaknesses in the implementation of big malicious systems. One of the examples which comes to my mind first is the ransomware, because, well, the idea of ransomware is not new, and I think it appeared maybe more than 6 years ago at one of the conferences. But then we have seen a couple of really good implementations in terms of the technical skills. And, well, different researchers made a lot of noise about it. And I actually regret that I participated in that personally. And I also did provide some analysis and, you know, in-depth description of that malware and of that problem, which probably made this problem and threat popular and common, because there were a lot of followers, a lot of newbies who wanted to try their skills in this area. And they introduced a lot of new malware, maybe not so professionally implemented, but still there were just a lot of new malicious applications based on the same idea.
So it was almost that the publicity and a detailed description of the architecture was putting ideas in people's minds.
Yeah, I think that they just have seen this scenario, the script of getting easy money while doing the development in this area. So they just took the idea and provided own implementation and started working on their own. So I think that was not good.
And, yeah, I can see where you're coming from, but at the same time, you would acknowledge that, you know, sweeping the threat under the carpet and not discussing it openly would be, you know, a mistake. And a discussion around the architecture wouldn't be, I can't imagine the architecture behind ransomware would be frighteningly complicated for anyone who has a basic understanding of cryptography.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, but at the same time, I think there should be still some regulations of disclosure of such information. Maybe it should be done on the closed conferences where only the researchers or trusted, verified people have access to, or maybe you have at least some profile, public profile, that people know that you are not making malware. So if you access this information about internals of the threats, you should be a trusted person.
Now, when you say regulated, I presume you mean industry self-regulation, not government stepping in to regulate it?
Well, it always starts at the industry level, but maybe interesting ideas may also come to the government level and may be implemented in the laws in the future, because currently we have very, very few regulations in this area, I think.
In terms of other threats, like more intricate analysis, when you see people analyzing stuff like Conficker or Gumblr or whatever, and then providing very, very detailed information to the public, you know, have you ever seen an instance where some very detailed analysis and criticisms and you know, descriptions of weaknesses in a particular malware have resulted in that the weaknesses in that malware disappearing later?
Yeah, of course. And we have seen, for example, if we take the very popular and well-known malware called Conficker or Kiddo, for example, last year when the researchers discovered that there was a weakness in the MD6 algorithm implementation, and it was publicly announced. The guys who developed Configure fixed that in their code as well.
So they really are paying attention.
Yeah, as they do. They read all our blogs. They follow us sometimes on Twitter, maybe, if you don't know about that. But still they do, and they tracking us, just like we track them.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's a difficult situation, isn't it? Because it's difficult to know where to draw the line. It's difficult to say, well, this analysis is okay because it doesn't give away that much information, whereas this analysis does give away too much. It reminds me of that McAfee blog post recently, which enabled someone to work out just from the blog post an Internet Explorer bug, right? So in that case, maybe a little bit too much information. But in other cases, it's not too much. I mean, so really, where do you draw that line?
It's a very difficult question. I agree. This is very difficult to draw this line. But I think we should introduce at least something to make people think about this problem. If we try to make some kind of regulations, people will start thinking about that, because perhaps some researchers just publish information they find. They just found something really interesting and something really new, and they want to share with the rest of the world. But they don't think about the consequences of this disclosure. So I think that introducing such changes or policies, by introducing that, we can change people's minds and researchers' minds when they do publish such information.
Do you think, though, that if people used a little bit more common sense in the sort of stuff they disclosed, then it would be a problem that wouldn't require regulation?
Totally. I agree. That would actually be good. But, you know, sometimes a lot of researchers still work for the commercial companies. And the commercial companies, they need sensations, they need the discoveries, and they need the news. So the description and detailed analysis of new threats is more than welcome, because it makes news, it makes business grow better and faster.
It's PR,
and
it's public relations, it's marketing,
exactly,
it's all of that.
Exactly,
yeah.
PR people are very interested in this. And the more sensational the news are, the better for the PR side of the business. That is why a lot of researchers just close their eyes and provide the details.
All right, Vitaly Kumlik, thank you very much for joining Risky Business, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Yeah, talk to you.
Oh, this is huge. If you can hit these notes, hey, I'm telling you, this is a big song. I need some moves, man. Come on. You're wearing spandex pants right now. Bring it on.
I can't explain all the feelings that you're making me feel.
Vitaly Kumlik on the line from Japan there, and that's it for this week's show. Now, normally you'd hear some, you know, interesting, cool, polished music in this spot, but you know what? Last Friday night, after Risky Business scooped those awards, I wound up in a rented karaoke room at a place called Ding Dong Dang in Surrey Hills, drunk out of my mind with a bunch of journalists and PRs until about 3 a.m, and you all know who you are. And unfortunately, for Risky Business listeners, I got audio. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I want to kiss you every minute, every hour, every day. You've got me in a spin, but everything is A-okay.
Now, look, in light of Risky Business's award, I feel I should thank a few people. I want to thank Wendy Hill of the company formerly known as Cybertrust for signing the first ever sponsorship check for the show. Mania Katardia for being our first ever news guest. Absolutely huge, massive thanks to Adam Boileau for coming on board as our weekly news analyst. And I know there are a lot of people out there who just tune in to hear Adam. So, you know, we love having him involved, and we definitely recognize his contribution. Thanks to all of the sponsors over the years who've made the show a success: Tenable, Checkpoint, Microsoft, Symantec, McAfee, Sophos, Veracode, Juniper, Verizon, and all of the others. There have been more. I can't think of them right now. I want to thank them for their support. And, you know, I don't believe that people actually tune into this podcast to hear me talking about stuff. The reason the show is a success is because people far more interesting than I am volunteer their time to be interviewed on the show. So massive thanks to all of the guests over the years. And last but certainly not least, thanks to you guys, the listeners, guys and gals. If no one listened to Risky Business, it would be pretty damn hard to get the guests to come on and even harder to get the sponsors. So thanks to you. Enjoy this terrible music. I believe in a thing called love.